Hello and welcome to the Nat Coombs Show on ESPN in association with Betfred. Good to have you with us, gang. Divisional round weekend coming into view, so we better get straight down to business and break it down for you. Two brilliant guests coming your way. Ollie Hunter making his season debut in a little bit. Ollie, of course, erstwhile producer, broadcaster, Packers expert, long-time member of the NFL UK community. So looking forward to getting all on the show for the first time this year. And Iron Mike leading things off. We're going to give the Packers game to Ollie, understandably. So the other three to Iron Mike, looking at all the key matchups, where those three games will be won and lost. So let's get straight to it. All right, Mike, what's occurring?
Well, it's raining outside, stuck inside. This is the first time I think that my son and I have both been on Zoom at the same time and doing different things. He's doing his year 12 studies, and his teacher forgot to send him a link for the Zoom meeting.
Let's hope those Zoom calls don't splice. Otherwise, you know, year 12 are going to start getting Mike's breakdown of the Bucks Saints game imminently.
Yeah, and you're gonna get chemistry A levels.
Great, so, yeah, that bring back some happy memories. Terrific stuff. All right, Mike, let's get down to business. Then three games we are previewing with you, starting with Bill Belichick's former charge, of course, these days rolling with it in Florida. Brady versus Breeze, Bucks Saints, probably for the last time. Breeze, we're all expecting to retire at the end of the season. A lot of emphasis as we go into this game, Mike, on the two matchups this season. The week one game where the Saints beat Tampa Bay pretty straightforward in the end, 34-23. Then, of course, it was a shellacking week nine, 38-3. But a lot has changed since week nine.
Absolutely. The battle of the ages is going to be a good one. Drew Brees' birthday is tomorrow, by the way.
Right.
So the number goes up to 85 from 84. I think that's kind of coincidental. And I think that this is definitely a different Bucks team. Mm. Things have come together, partly, I think, working out the Arians Brady compromise sort of on how the offense should run. More directly, Antonio Brown has made a big difference in this team, which people haven't noticed that much because he hasn't had this huge game in it, but he's always another threat. Mike Evans, you know, is not 100%. It's easy to see that. But Brown is always that big play threat, even on short passes. So that's made a huge difference. It gives Brady those multiple mismatch possibilities that he thrives on. And if you watched last week's game, Gronk, who I had said to everybody, you know, touchdown scorer, Gronk, take Gronk in this one. Gronk only had one pass thrown to him. He was basically doing what the Patriots did with him in the Super Bowl run the year they beat the Rams. He was acting as a third tackle.
Right.
And you remember him and Trent Brown, you know, clearing out people on the line of scrimmage. That wasn't such a big thing because Ronald Jones wasn't there, but Fournette had a good game, his best game since he was a Jag. Mm-hmm. The other key thing was he was blocking one-on-one with Chase Young quite a bit. And Young, you know, the thing with Brady, which people forget, is that they say, oh, they've got a great pass rush. If your pass rush is going to come from the outside with Brady, he's going to step forward.
Right.
His first move is always to step forward, even after the Giants figured that out and beat him twice in Super Bowls, on a game plan basically based by making sure that he couldn't step forward. Justin Tuck in particular, coming up the middle, making sure he had hands inside so that OC and the other guys could rush on the outside and trap him that way. So, you know, I look for New Orleans to be able to do that. You know, I wouldn't be surprised to even see them switching some of the ends like Jordan inside on occasion on their pass rush. And they're a very good defensive team. You know, and I think people are overlooking how steady a defensive team they are and how effective they were last week against the Bears. Now, understanding that the Bears are not a dynamite offensive team, but New Orleans is the only team in the playoffs who are in the top five in terms of points allowed and points scored. They're fifth in each category, which points isn't the greatest, you know, measure of how good or bad your defense is, but it's a sign that it's a quality defense.
Just in terms of the battle of the trenches, Mike, to elaborate on that a bit more, ESPN's Jenna Lane wrote a great piece about how and why the Bucks offense is markedly different from that week nine game. And you've nailed that Antonio Brown was somebody she emphasized as well. But she also talked about Ali Marpet being out from the line in that game and how that had a significant impact into all in all kinds of ways, including communication. So now they're at full strength. How do you see that battle playing out? You said it's a very impressive Saints D. They're going to have a clear game plan for Brady. Are they going to be able to execute it?
Well, that's always the question, isn't it? I think that line is pretty good. And Wirfs, the rookie right tackle, has been excellent. You know, and probably Armstead's had a great season, and a great season for him means staying healthy, which has been his problem throughout his career. They got another rookie in there, Ruiz at guard, who was a center in college, but they already had McCoy there at center. So it's a very, very solid offensive line. And the key to their game is running. I mean, when Kamara has a good running game, then the short passing game opens up even more, and they are a short passing team. That's the one thing that Tampa might be able to take advantage of. And they're fairly well equipped to cut off a short passing game. Their defense has been up and down through the season. You hardly know what defense is going to show up. And since Vita Vea was injured, that was a big part of the game. They picked up McClendon eventually to replace him, and he's a decent player, but he's not Vita Vea. He's not a big, massive presence the way he is. And that could make the difference. New Orleans works on flexibility. They've got a good secondary. Lattimore, you know, will be probably assigned to try to shut down one or the other receivers and make Brady's life a little bit more difficult that way. I know a lot of people are saying it's hard to beat a team three times in a season. And it is, I suppose. But I'm not sure that that's a solid rule to follow in this. I'm not sure that the Tampa is good enough defensively to keep New Orleans within scoring range, and New Orleans might be good enough defensively to hold Brady down. So, you know, it's a really tough call. There's a couple of games this week that are really tough calls, but I know that a lot of people, if they're thinking upset, they're going to be thinking, you know, this is the one that's going to be the upset. You know, Tom Brady can't lose three times in a season. Drew Brees doesn't have the arm that he had. You know, it's going to be good, and players on their birthdays tend to play better. I'm not sure on the day after their birthday, whether they do or not. Yeah. There was an interesting essay by Bill James on that years ago.
I'm expecting Breeze to have a fairly quiet and early night. As Tom Brady, of course, as we know, likes to be in bed by 8:30, apparently. Just on...
If I was married to Giselle, I probably would too.
Just on the progression of this Bucks offense and what that has done. And I know there's still plenty of ball to play, so maybe this question will be easier to answer at the end of the season when we know exactly how it's played out. But the fact that they've got to the divisional round, they've been rolling certainly for the last 6-7 weeks. What has that done to those detractors, Mike, or the argument that the detractors have put forward about Tom Brady, that he wouldn't really be able to thrive anywhere outside of New England, on the basis that Brady comes back next year as well and does more of the same? What has this final chapter of his career done to his legacy?
I mean, obviously, if they went on to even make the Super Bowl, it would be greatly enhanced. But I don't, you know, I never paid much attention to those people in the first place. You know, they struggled a bit in the beginning, but they were still winning some games. And this was a team that was, as I said, as other people said at the beginning, Tampa was a team that was a better team than their record because Jameis Winston, for all of his touchdown passes, turned the ball over and cost them 2 or 3 wins almost individually last season. So they weren't a 7-9 team. They were a 9-7 team, maybe a 10-6 team. And they added Brady. They added Gronk. They added other players. You know, they built a contender. They went out and got the makings of a contender. So I think it's been relatively easy for him to do what he wants to do. In the last month, he's looked like a much younger Tom Brady. He's looked better than he did the last couple of years in New England, for sure. Yeah. And that tells you a lot about what he had around him in New England. You know, that it was hard for him to be a transition quarterback, which is what he had to be in New England. It was easier for him to be a a leader quarterback on a loaded team, you know, and not that the Bucs are the best team in the league, but on a team that was playoff caliber when he got there.
And they are stacked. And on that point, that's another faintly ridiculous argument that your favorite phrase, the mouth clowns, have been spitting out for a lot of the season. He's got too much talent around him. I mean, but in all seriousness, is that ever a genuine problem that you can have too much talent around you? Because I look at that and think that's an absurd argument.
Yeah,
is there any validity in it at all? I just don't get the rationale.
The problem with having too much talent around you, as it's defined, is simply trying to keep that together.
Keep the players happy.
Keep the players happy, but more important, the next year, can you keep the team together?
Right. Okay.
That tends not, you know, having too much talent tends not to last.
Yeah.
Because guys move on, and everybody wants to
get paid,
that they're a star, and they want to get paid, and there's nothing wrong with that, you know. But yes, that team has, you know, what would you say? I'm just taking a quick look down the depth chart here, you know, and any number of players who could be Pro Bowl, you know, legitimate Pro Bowl contenders, and a great draft, because Wirfs, you know, has been a great rookie, and Winfield on defense has been a great rookie. You know, so they hit on those two. They've had other contributors down there. I think it's a team that's built to succeed within Brady's time frame.
Yeah.
You know, if they don't go all the way this year, people will be expecting them to be a real contender next year, especially if Breeze retires. They become the favorites in the division next season. I think almost without a doubt.
That's a great point, actually. This is kind of win or bust for, you would think, for New Orleans. Well, it depends on the succession plan, of course, but it's certainly maybe a better opportunity than they have for the next few years to go all the way. Let's move on to Ravens-Bills, another pick'em game.
Mike. Yeah.
There's a huge amount of praise for the Ravens D, Wink Martindale, their coordinator, because all season long, and particularly how they shut down Derrick Henry so effectively in the wild card, the super wild card round, but the Bills pose a different threat, don't they? So how does this Baltimore D match up with Josh Allen and the Bills?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And Martindale hasn't had any offers, I think, as far as I know,
crazy
for head coaching. And a lot of people think it's crazy, not just because he's good with the X's and O's, but because he's from all reports, a really good leadership type, an affable type that the players love to play for, you know,
kind of Adam Gaze type. Yeah.
Yeah. And that can work against you because, you know, we've seen mad dog defensive coordinators, you know, who are not great head coaches because they lose the other half of the team or they don't have a big picture. Buddy Ryan springs to mind in that sense, a brilliant defensive coordinator. But you know, you can't run both sides of your game on beating the other side of your team.
He hated offense.
You know, yeah. And but
it's a bit of a drawback, isn't it? Yeah.
What they did in against Tennessee was and it's good for, it's easy for them to do in a sense, because they're basically a 3-4 team, and they have a good front three. And one of their problems earlier in the season was that guys like Calais Campbell weren't fully healthy. You know, they needed to get that together. So they were moving everybody back a little bit and reading. They were really playing read and react, which is what a three front defense does anyway, because you're asking your big beefs to hold up the blockers. The three guys' job is to hold up five blockers, basically. And you're asking the other guys to read and react, you know, but they have to do it quickly. So that did two things. It both let them rush to the ball to find the hole to stop Derrick Henry. And they were going low on Derrick Henry from what I could see, but it also let them kind of flood the short passing lanes that the Titans like to use, especially with their tight ends. And that wasn't very successful for them either. So again, it depended on them being able to man cover the receivers. So they basically man covered AJ Brown and
Corey Davis,
the whole game. When they zoned, Peters got his interception.
I've got just an interesting theory, because we look at the neutralization of Henry and the impact that had on the play action game as well. Because obviously, you know, if you're eliminating that, it's bound to have an impact on the play action game, and that is a big part of that Titans offense. But I'm interested in your, because I've heard that theory being bandied around quite a lot, But I'm interested in your take on it, because in the game earlier on in the season, they shut Henry down for three quarters and then he blew up in the fourth quarter in overtime. So is there ever a, I guess what I'm asking is, if you're shutting down a running back like Henry for the majority of the game, how much impact does that have on the play action? Because at any point he could go off if you take your eye off it.
Yeah, the funny part about play action is that you don't actually have to have a good run game in order to be able to run it. It's almost the idea of it. And
right, the threat of it, exactly.
Yeah, I always laugh when you see guys biting on the play fake when the team that's doing it is down by 17. Sure. When you know it's third and eight, you know, yeah, they're going to throw, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, and
but is that guys, different with Henry? Cause he could go at any time. Is
yeah,
that,
I mean, you have to acknowledge that Henry can break it. If he breaks the first tackle, he's going to be hard to bring down. So you have to allow for that. And they were never wildly ahead in that game either. So, you know, it wasn't like the Titans had to throw. Mm. So you had to respect that, but that's the way that defense was set up. As long as you didn't pinch so much that Tannehill's bootleg series, you know, was going to kill you, which is what happened the week before. You know, Tannehill had a number of plays where they were really selling out run blitzing from the outside to stop Henry, and Tannehill had easy
made hay.
They didn't do that. They were very careful to avoid it. I thought it was a great plan. Now against the Bills, this becomes a different story, because the Bills running actually isn't going to worry you. Singletary and Moss. Now, yeah, they can break a run, but you can also contain them. So my question will be whether they're doing something similar. The Bills receivers, Stephon Diggs, and probably who's ever on the outside. Now, John Brown has looked awful since he came back, and, you know, he may still be, you know, suffering effects, as it were.
Yeah.
But the rookie, Gabriel Davis, has looked really good, replacing Brown, and does more things than Brown does. He goes across the middle better. So, you know, I expect that they'll man cover Diggs and maybe even double him, because Diggs obviously is the key there. And then they'll count on that same kind of squeezing the middle to keep Cole Beasley under control. You know, and in the conditions in Buffalo, which it doesn't appear it's like it's going to be snowing, but it's going to be cold and windy.
40% chance of snow, apparently.
Yeah. It's you
I'm
know,
an optimist. Like, I'm hoping it will.
Like 30, you know, mid 30s probably, may be a couple of degrees too high, but it's going to be windy as well. So that could make the passing game difficult. And that's what leads me to think Baltimore is in with a better shot in this game, because the Bills really are a pass first team. And, you know, what were they? They scored over 500 points. And I saw a really interesting thing that, you know, of all the teams that have scored over 500 points in a season in the last, whatever it was, years, only two have actually won the Super Bowl.
Really?
Yeah.
Of course, that go figure. Hey, our friend Mike Tanier had a really interesting point on that passing game. So he pulled the stat in his column from Sports Info Solutions, was the source. The Bills led the NFL in completions and yards to the left and right sidelines in the regular season. And Mike was talking about
I know where he's going. Yeah, I know where you're going with this. Lamar Jackson doesn't.
Right, exactly. So they don't have that range. So if we're talking about neutralizing respective threats, because this was the interesting thing, the flip side of this against Tennessee, when we were talking about this on the Edge Rush show, we looked at if both sides managed to shut down and neutralize the primary part of that team's offense, so the ground game in both cases in the Baltimore-Tennessee game, then what's left? And there's more upside with Baltimore, and Lamar proved that perfectly, of course, with one of the plays of recent playoff memory. So if the same thing happens here, if the Ravens are able to neutralize Diggs and to shut down the impact of the passing game in the way that you've described, Mike, and conversely, the Bills are able to limit Gus Edwards and J.K. Dobbins and the ground game, then where did Baltimore go next?
When you watch Lamar Jackson throwing, his looks are basically up the middle. He doesn't have the arm strength, and so he looks to the middle. He can place balls nicely on deep passes, but they're a two-receiver team as well for the most part. And Willie Snead, like Brown, has not looked good since he came back. So you've got Hollywood Brown. And then you've got Mark Andrews, the tight end, as their two big receiving threats. They like to throw to the backs a lot. So does Buffalo, for that matter. But where they go is Lamar Jackson running. And, you know, and they'll go to Lamar. And if you're watching, you know, Tennessee did a pretty good job of holding him in check until he dodged the rush and went up the middle. And, you know, the guy spying him, and I can't remember who it was, but missed the tackle basically at the line of scrimmage or a yard behind. And once he was past that, he was pretty much gone. And so I think Buffalo is pretty well equipped to keep him under control, in the sense that they have a couple of really quick linebackers. And I wouldn't be surprised if they came out in nickel, strangely enough. But Edmonds and Matt Milano are both really, you know, fast, and they may even play those two plus a spy. I don't know exactly how they'll do it, but I do know that Buffalo is primarily a zone defense team. Sean McDermott has always been that kind of way. And when you play Baltimore, you almost have to be in zone, you know, or maybe you let one guy man cover. You let Tre'Davious White cover Hollywood Brown to take him out of the game. But when you're playing zone, it's a simple fact of life. When you're playing zone, you can see what's happening in front of you. When you're playing man to man, some of your defenders are going to have their backs to the line of scrimmage, and they're not going to see when Lamar Jackson breaks the pocket, when he goes, you know, and becomes a runner. And that's a huge advantage for Lamar Jackson. Yeah. So, you know, I think in that sense, the Bills are pretty well equipped to stop the run. They're not bad up front. People are saying, oh, they're, you know, they're not bad up front. Ed Oliver is a really good player. You know, they've got a couple of guys who played in Carolina for McDermott, like Addison and Butler. And that, I think, to me is where the matchup is going to be won or lost, is how well they can control the planned running game and force Jackson to the pocket and then control him when he's in the pocket. That's almost the key. And it's a big ask. And I think it's why Baltimore, almost could, you know, they're not going to be favorites, obviously, but this game to me is a pick 'em.
Yeah. I couldn't,
you know,
agree more.
And if you were betting, I know you've done your betting podcast, but if you were betting, I would probably skip the points entirely and just take them on the money line.
Take the money. Yeah, that's what we did. Although, I won't give up the ghost. You have to go and listen to Ed Rush, see which way we shaved there. But let's talk Browns Chiefs, because, you know, seemingly more clear cut. Certainly the Chiefs at the time of recording this are double digit favorites. Those shy and retiring Pittsburgh Steelers, I'm like, Chase Claypool has said that the Browns are going to get clapped by the Chiefs.
Yeah.
A bit harsh.
I wish they just, you know, look, you're done. Go home. Shut up. You know? Pittsburgh's a team with a lot of work to do, I think, in the offseason. A lot of big questions to answer that are going to be difficult for them to answer, because they're a franchise that prides themselves on continuity, you know, and hanging with things.
What Claypool means is they give them a guard of honor when they come on the field and clap them that way. That could be what they go where they go with it.
Yeah, maybe someone will stomp on the logo at the center of the field, you know, which
if they're putting on TikTok, otherwise it doesn't count.
Yeah. What are we, 6 years old, you know?
If somebody stomps on a logo and you're not recording it on TikTok, does it really happen?
If it doesn't get slimed on Nickelodeon, does it really happen?
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And you know, I think that it's fair what he says. And when you look at the way it breaks down, the Browns are fairly simple defensively to be able to attack in ways that Kansas City will attack them. And I think that to me is what leads me to, you know, pick Kansas City for the game. I think everybody straight up would pick Kansas City for this game, including Chase Claypool.
He's definitely on that train. Just on neutralizing Mahomes, I'm keen to get your take on that, Mike, because I guess Belichick's had the most success in the past in that respect. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, they've done well. I mean, you know, they did well this year when they played them. You know, if their offense had been able to, you know, what that was the game that Hoyer threw away.
Right. Yeah.
You know, when they were, what was it, 3-3 at the time, I think, half, and they could have been going into that at half 6-3 when Hoyer messed that up. And basically, they try to control Mahomes in the pocket, not let him get outside very often, but they block his throwing lanes for the most part. They play mostly zone when they're playing him, and they try to take away with what you might call robber coverage in some ways, getting a safety up or a linebacker back. They try to take away that middle of the field for Travis Kelce. So it's like, you're not going to beat us deep. We're not going to let Tyreek Hill get behind us and bet a big play. And we're not going to give you lots and lots of crosses and drag routes to Travis Kelce.
Do you think that we're going to see a number of plays dialed up that Reed and Bieniemy have been sitting on that waiting for the
yeah.
playoffs?
Yeah, I'd love to. I hope so.
Yeah.
But that's a situational kind of thing. If they need them, they will. I don't think they'll go. Well, you can always go to one early if you want to get that first score. But, you know, I mean, think about last year when they went behind to the Texans, you know, and then came back and routed them.
Shellacked, yeah.
Yeah. And did the Texans trade Deshaun Watson for James Harding?
I think so. There are rumors,
a lot of buzz
on Twitter.
Yeah. I was getting the headlines confused, but
I think it was a four-team trade. So I think the Chargers are involved as well.
I think this is going to be a real test for the Cleveland defense. Their game plan, I would assume, would be to control the ball on the ground. I mean, who needs coaches anyway? They didn't have a coach. They only practiced 2 days last week. But Stefanski, in my mind, is one of the front runners for coach of the year. And that was simply a case to me of bringing in a guy who was going to be able to do what you needed to do with your biggest weapon, your most important, which is Baker Mayfield. They brought in a guy who was perfectly suited to get the best out of Baker Mayfield. And that's what he did. And you know, they're not Baker hasn't carried this team, but Baker's done exactly what he needs to do to make the team successful.
With the ground game, Mike, everyone talks about the Achilles heel, defensively speaking, of the Chiefs being the run D, right? And obviously that's the strong suit of the Browns offense. Jay Bell on our show on Monday, Mike, talked about Spags liking to take out to neutralize your primary threat, Belichickian style, right? So in terms of that matchup, how bad is this Chiefs run D? Because we keep hearing it's terrible. That's how you gash the Chiefs. But is it as bad as everybody makes out?
Well, it's bad numerically, I suppose. But they've got people up there, you know, who can stop the run. I think the problem lies mostly at the second level, at the linebacker spot. Their front is not that bad. And the question is, if you sell out to stop the run,
what are you giving up?
What are you giving up? And with the Browns, it's mostly Jarvis Landry you have to worry about. They do scheme pretty well to get the tight end involved. Higgins has made some catches, but it's mostly Landry. So I would actually be tempted if I were Spags to shut off Jarvis Landry, try to take him out of the game, you know, and then stop the run and make the other guys beat you. Harrison Bryant, Rashad Higgins, you know, those guys are going to beat you. Those guys are going to beat you, but not let Landry, unlike the Steelers, for example. But they won't go down 28-0, hopefully in the first quarter. Wasn't that just like and you were on the sidelines. I know I was up in the booth, but that first play of the game, it was like Peyton Manning at
the Super Bowl. Yeah.
At
really.
Giant Stadium. It was like deja vu all over again.
Yeah. Simmons and Cousin Sal were quite funny on this, saying, why were they approaching the ball, Belichick and Belichick, Roethlisberger and Pouncey, like it was some kind of bomb or landmine.
I think what happened was that Roethlisberger looked down at James Conner and Conner didn't want to like dive and hurt his quarterback. And Roethlisberger was kind of looking like, well, you take it. I don't really want to dive at all.
It's amazing.
And it was really funny.
Just in that game, the Browns ended up giving up over 500 yards of offense to Pittsburgh.
Right.
How much attention should we pay to that, given the fact that the Steelers were in a hole, it was an area of assault?
That's why yardage is a bad indicator of how good a defense is, because it's situational. And points are not that great either, because when you're up like that, you're going to let Ben dink and dunk. Lots of passes and come up with lots of yards. And then,
but he was carving them up quite easily for a lot of that time as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, and I think that's what the Chiefs are going to be able to do to a certain extent as well, as long as they can keep Myles Garrett, you know, off of Mahomes, and as long as Andy doesn't sort of like punt on fourth and one and down. What was Tomlin? He was down 13, I think, and he punted.
In the fourth quarter. I mean, after they mounted his comeback, incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking, you know, you deserve everything you get here. And I mean, the other thing they could do is what the Packers have done, and I know you'll talk to my man Ollie about this, but you know, that game matches up a 39-year-old left tackle on one team, Andrew Whitworth, who has no business being healthy enough to play. I mean, you know, he's rehabbed an injury in like record time, and for guys over 300 pounds, that's not easy when you're talking about knees. Right. And he had a great game for the Rams last week, and the Packers went out and signed, you mentioned Bakhtiari being out, they went and signed Jared Veld here, who started for the Colts last weekend. And I mean, it's a COVID thing, you know, but it's probably the first time in NFL history, or certainly probably since the 1920s, in the days when they were like the rugby league and you would buy guys in for the playoffs, you know, and that a guy has started in the playoffs for two different teams. Yeah, in two incredible. Different weeks. And I have no doubt he's going to start. You know, join the team on Tuesday or whatever. He'll go through three practices and start because he's basically that good a tackle, and he's rested and ready. Mm-hmm. And you know, I love this idea. You sit out the whole season, you play two games for one team and one game for another team, two of them in the playoffs. And
well, why stop there, Mike? I mean, I think you just bounce into, you know, whoever progresses has to take him onto their roster for the next, for the next game, get him to the Super Bowl.
I'm not sure if they can now, because it was a thing of his being on the practice squad.
Okay.
And because you were allowed to, you know, to promote and then demote guys off the practice squad, he was able to be taken. By the Packers, but I think the Packers have him on the active roster. So, I hope they do. it would be great, wouldn't it? You know, it's like
an eligible player.
It's like, I don't know. It would be really good if someone said, you know, Deshaun Watson's not doing anything this week. Why don't we bring him in? We'll take a look at him on a kind of trial 7-day buy or return basis. Now the NFL would be so much more interesting
if we could do that. Just pick up. We could get more of your thoughts on the divisional round on your Patreon column, right? Patreon.com/com. Mike Carlson, FMTE.
Yeah. It's a big week this week too. I've got a lot of stuff to write about, based on what's happened. The all rookie team's going to be out there as well.
Nice.
It's the coaching carousel, which we haven't even mentioned, but you know, there's bodies falling by the wayside. I was the first, I think, to suggest realistically that Doug Peterson could be up for the axe.
Right.
Mike McCarthy, although I think that firing the McCarthy's job Nolan. Is safe. I think that's what firing Mike Nolan and hiring Dan Quinn does for you. But the Peterson thing didn't really surprise me at all. Although when you read on what I'll be writing about are some of the intricacies that have been suggested, you know, about that. It wasn't that he had a bad season. It was he had a bad season and went in and didn't want to change anything, which was his problem ever since he's lost Frank Reich.
Should he have been given more grace because of the Super Bowl win, do you think?
I think he's already been given that, you know, and I think what they needed at some point, and we talked about this, you know, after the first year, you know, instead of bringing in an offensive coordinator, he promoted two of his position coaches jointly. And what that meant was he was the offensive coordinator. And he needed that input from someone like Frank Reich, who was also calling the plays. He wanted to call the plays. So, you know, I think that's a problem. Jim Schwartz left. You have to look for a replacement. You can keep promoting. Bill Belichick's done that. You know, only very occasionally brought in somebody from the outside, but that's because he coaches everything. And he has a better track record of it. You know, Doug had the one good run.
Right.
So, you know, I love the rumor that he's going to that he could be hired by the Seahawks to be the offensive coordinator. Mm. Although, you know, my gut feeling is that Pete Carroll wants someone who will run the ball even more often than Brian Schottenheimer.
Is that possible? What's Chad Gailey up to? Actually, Chad Gailey's a free agent. Maybe Chad's a free agent.
Yeah. Chad'll get in there. Yeah. That's an interesting one too. Because I thought Chan and Tua were a pretty good fit. And now everybody who was saying the Dolphins were tanking for Tua is now saying the Dolphins have to trade Tua.
Draft a quarterback.
I won't mention what game it was, but I was watching one of the games by, and I won't mention who was broadcasting it, but literally the play-by-play guy shouts the whole game like he's doing PTI. And the lead color guy, they have two color guys, the lead color guy contradicted himself constantly. He would say something and then a minute and a half later literally contradict himself with what he was saying, and no one would say a word about it. Yeah. And I'm saying, yeah, well, it's easy to be a really sharp commentator if you can change your mind every minute and a half. They've got to do this, and then they do it. They can't do that.
What are they doing?
Said they have to do it.
It's like Statler and Waldorf. I think we should get Statler and Waldorf. They get Nickelodeon to do games. I think we should get Statler and Waldorf to call a game.
You know, if you and I were a little bit more like Brady and Breeze age wise, we could be Statler and Waldorf. I mean, I'm already there.
Hey, I'm not far behind,
I don't want to have to fight over which one I am.
That's the worst show I've ever seen. You weren't here last week. That's my favorite one. On that note, we've got to get out of Dodge. Cracking stuff, Mike. Mike Carlson, FMTE, is the Patreon column. Check out I'm Mike Starnes. We'll push that out on our social channels as well. Come back and see us soon, bud.
Always a pleasure.
Brilliant stuff from Iron Mike. He'll be back very soon. You can count on that. Three games down, one to go. Let's look at Packers-Rams with Ollie Hunter. Ollie Hunter, it's great to see you. Great to have you on the show. And I love the fact, as all our best guests take things seriously, dressed up with a resplendent in a red Texas Tech hoodie.
Yes, I have. Well, I knew I was following Carlson, so I had to do something kind of kitsch or neat or something like that. I got this Texas Tech Red Raiders jersey when I went to see Patrick Mahomes. I went to see Patrick Mahomes play for the Texas Tech Red Raiders against Baylor, and he slung, I think it was six touchdowns in a Thanksgiving Saturday game. It was amazing. He was incredible. And I didn't realize at the time what I was witnessing in the fact that it would be a bona fide Hall of Famer. He would end up winning the Super Bowl. I mean, I thought, yeah, this guy's good. He may or may not do something in the NFL. But so I had to get a jumper anyway. Every college game that I go to in the States, I love to get something from that team. So up here, if you're watching on the video, rubbish for the podcast stuff, but I've got also a Christian McCaffrey bobblehead, which when we went to go and see Stanford, they were giving out to every single person that arrived. I think they had loads left over because it was a game against the Oklahoma State Beavers, and there was hardly anyone there.
Go Beavers! So,
yeah, it was good. It was great seeing Mahomes. I didn't get to see McCaffrey. I still haven't seen McCaffrey yet, but fingers crossed I will.
Loving that. I love that idea. We've done a chunk of Super Bowls together and trips anywhere you are. Just grab always grab merch from the city you're in. That's a given. That's a day one a lock. All right, we're gonna primarily concentrate on the Packers. If we squeeze in a bit of time at the end on the coaching carousel, some of the news there, changes that have been made this week. But we want to talk about Packers because, of course, you are a broadcaster, producer, an NFL diehard, and a Packers diehard. So we thought, who better to get on the show to talk about the Packers season today and this matchup as well, which is intriguing, isn't it? Because a lot of people talking up the teams left in the race. The Packers match up quite unfavorably against the Rams because we're talking about the best defense in the NFL. Almost all statistical categories, I think the eye test, most people would agree the Rams are the best in business. And we've seen earlier on this season, of course, that despite the brilliance of Rodgers this year and the offense absolutely flowing, you can disrupt them. The Bucs had a lot of success in getting that train off the track. So let's start there. And the key matchups offensively and defensively, the Packers offense and the Rams D?
Well, Rodgers is he's 0-4 the last four games against number one ranked defenses, which doesn't bode well for him, for the Packers, when you've got the number one ranked defense coming into town. However, Aaron Donald, the Terminator, as I saw.
McVay called him.
The Rams, McVay called him that, and the Rams have put that up on their Twitter. He suffered some issues in and around the ribcage area. I mean, they're going to say he's good to go. He is. It looks like he will be good to go. He even came back into the game.
That shows how hard he is. It's rib cartilage, isn't it? And that is one of the most painful injuries you can get. And there is no chance he's missing. I guess the question is it going to impact him at all? I mean, you're hoping that he's not going to be at full strength. There's no way they'll be able to keep him on the sidelines and not play, though, is there?
Well, exactly right. But they do have some more than adequate backups, but you're going to get him to suit up. And when you've got him and the rest of the guys on that line going up against the Green Bay offensive line, which has played exceptionally well the entire season. However, losing David Bakhtiari, just voted for his third Pro Bowl in his career, but widely regarded as one of the best left tackles in the business. They're going to struggle because you have to double team Aaron Donald. Mm. And even when you do double team him, he can still get round that. If you single team him on the outside, he often gets round that. And he's got such pace, brilliant hands. So the hand stuff, the hand fighting that you get, he is so good at maneuvering offensive linemen away or tight ends away. Mm. But the Packers, they do have the best blocking tight end in the league in Mercedes Lewis, who will come in and obviously help out on that left-hand side. That's going to be a real, real struggle in and around the trenches. Rodgers has been pressured far less than he has ever done this season. He's had far less quarterback hits, but that game against the Bears, that last game, essentially that was the Packers' wild card game because they had to win that to get the number one. The Bears needed to win it or to get into the playoffs. They lost and still made it anyway. But he was hit six times. The whole 15 games before that with Bakhtiari and Co in and around, he was only hit 20 times. Mm. So without Bakhtiari, it's far, far more difficult. But Rodgers, there's a key thing about trust between Rodgers and LaFleur. In previous years, the back end of the McCarthy era, and to a certain extent last year, even though the Packers made a run to the divisional championship, Rodgers was taking far less hits and not prepared to be hit as he threw the ball. He would either throw it away, which you can get stung for various things like intentional grounding and such like. But he's now willing to take that hit. He's now willing to say, right, I'll take the hit because I trust my receivers. I trust the offensive play caller in Matt LaFleur. I trust him for that ball to be taken.
It's fascinating, the LaFleur connection. I want to drill down on that more and talk about, because you're watching the Packers week in, week out, watching all the game film. Talk about that, because we see the numbers. They're the top scoring offense in the league, hitting almost 31 points a game. Offensively, we're a better, much more efficient team and playing with a lot more confidence, says Rodgers, right? We know the narrative of the draft and the fact that outside of taking his successor, which apparently has motivated him quite significantly, it also had the duality of short stacking them when they could have taken a receiver or another skill position, the scrabble, the trade deadline to look at getting in Fuller and trying to bring in a receiver, which is very unpackers like to try and do a deal before the deadline. So we're hearing all these things, seeing all these things, and obviously seeing week in, week out, most weeks, them absolutely flying. But break that down for us a bit more, Ollie, because you're right. Last season, the record was deceptive. It was Rodgers almost ignoring, certainly going his own way a lot of the time from what we could work out, and crucially not buying into the game plan. He's buying into it this time. So what's changed?
Well, I think there was an element of buying into it to a certain extent. So the first two or three drives were always scripted. Mm-hmm. So there would be hurry up offense. There would be scripted plays. And And this is last season I'm talking about. And then once the game plan had gone, or that scripted element had gone, that's where Rodgers would then go to his default, which was at the back end of the Mike McCarthy era, where he wasn't trusting what was going on, the play calling. He would change the play at the line of scrimmage all the time. Mm. That's not happening as much this year. We're seeing Rodgers more and more in the pocket. He's doing less scrambling, less freelancing, as it's called. But what's also really, really helped is a proper running game. So Aaron Jones has, again, had another stellar year. Jamal Williams has backed him up, and we've brought in AJ Dillon, a draft pick from earlier this year as well. They're all – Jones and Williams are kind of similar. Good north-south, good catching the ball out of the backfield. AJ Dillon's a third down running back, change of pace. He's a big guy. He reminds me of Derrick Henry, actually. Mm-hmm. And we'll see him more and more used, I think, in this playoff run, as defenses are tiring over having had to play 18 weeks or whatever. But we're seeing wide receivers running their routes better, wide receivers catching the ball better. We're seeing the tight end Robert Tonyan, rhymes with onion, catching the ball and getting a load of touchdowns, something that Jimmy Graham wasn't doing for Green Bay. Weirdly, he ended up doing it for Chicago. But yeah, right. So it's a myriad of things coming together, players playing up. Devontae Adams is outrageous, by the way. He is clearly the number one receiver in the league. Yeah. I don't care what anyone says.
It's not close. This season is not close. What about the supporting cast? Because, clearly Promise, you mentioned some of them there, but, Valdez Scantling, but flaws as well. Is that, do you get a sense, Rodgers, much like Brady, I think, and it's probably no coincidence that they demand a lot from their receivers. If there's a mistrust there, you're in the doghouse, forget about getting any looks. How is that gone? Because certainly in the middle of the season, there was a phase where, I guess, around the time of the trade deadline when they were looking to bring Fuller in, right? That we haven't got a complete set here, but that seems to have been, they Packers seem to have moved on from that. What's your perspective on how strong this receiving core actually is?
I think the receiving core is really strong. You've got the number one wide receiver in the league. Mm-hmm. Valdez Scantling is your real deep threat guy. His hands have come into question, but he has raw speed. He beats people with one or two movements and then gets down the field. And Rodgers is one of the most accurate passes on deep balls. He hasn't been throwing them much, actually, this year. But when he does, invariably, it ends up being either a really big gain or a touchdown. We had one last or 2 weeks ago against the Bears where Valdez Scantling could have put Green Bay up. It was the first drive out of this into the second half. Could have put Green Bay up 28-3, I think it was. And we know what kind of score that is. But I think the key element, the big, big thing is Alan Lazard. Alan Lazard, number 13, he wears on his back if you're watching on Saturday. He is a guy who does everything really well. He runs his routes well. He catches balls well. But crucially, he's like when he's in the game, especially on either running downs or downs where he is not going to be the primary receiver, he's a really good blocker. He's like a tight end, but plays the wide receiver and essentially is a wide receiver. He reminds me of the latter years of Larry Fitzgerald.
Wow.
The Japanese fighting fish, where Larry was used a lot out of the slot, but very much as a blocking wide receiver for schemes, for running back running schemes or dump off schemes as well. So all of those things are coming together. And Rodgers loves Alan Lazard. You get to, if you find anything on YouTube about or on the Green Bay website about Rodgers talking about Alan Lazard, he loves him. Lazard was missing for a few games mid-season, and the offense was different. Now that everyone's back together, fit and healthy, that can only be a good thing.
Okay, so let's look at the ways that you can beat this team, because strong, and we haven't even talked about Za'Darius Smith and Jair Alexander and the brilliant pieces in the D, and maybe we'll get onto that in a minute. But Rob Domofsky, who is a writer I know you're a big fan of, I'm a company man, Ollie, so of course I'm gonna drop the ESPN names, but interesting piece in the build-up to the game, ESPN Packers writer, a beat writer, in case you haven't followed his work, quoting a scout talking about how you can take down Aaron Rodgers and this incarnation of the Packers. You need a powerful run game and an elite defensive line, right? Well, that's exactly what the Rams have, right? They've got an elite defensive line and they got Cam Akers, who is lighting things up right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Cam Akers, what the Rams have done really well is really use their backs sparingly. The start of the season, it was a Darius Henderson job. Then Malcolm Brown would come in and take some reps, and Cam Akers would sit on the back burner. But he's now coming really into some form. The Packers, up until the last 6 weeks of the season, had a real problem against the run, a real problem. Dalvin Cook had 200 yards from scrimmage. Ronald Jones ran all over them. The Indianapolis Colts, when they beat the Packers, also had a really good day on the ground. So the Packers really struggled. That was sorted out by Mike Pettine et al. And it pains me to say it because I'm not the biggest Pettine fan. And
right.
the Packers didn't allow a 100-yard rusher for the last six of games of the season.
Right.
So that has been fixed to some extent. When you're talking about that, a stout defensive line, the offensive line of the Packers have really stepped up as well. Mm. In that, going back to that defense though, the run has been stopped because Kenny Clark, it's coincided with Kenny Clark coming back from injury, and also moving some of the linebackers, like Oren Burks, Christian Kirksey, from rather pass rushing. They're now trusting the two Smiths to get pressure and leaving them sort of hovering and waiting for running backs to break through the offensive line, the defensive line of the Packers. So the linebackers are really spying what opposing rushers are actually doing, then bring them down before you get those big gains.
I wonder how much of an impact that will have in terms of which quarterback starts for the Rams, because of course at the time of recordings that's a big question, because both Jared Goff and Wolford have injuries. Wolford had a stinger, incidentally. That was why he went out of that game. Presumably you've had a stinger playing cricket, because I know you love your cricket. If you ever, yeah. What's the worst stinger? Actually, no, we probably won't know where to go there. Is there a big difference there? Because obviously upside, you can look at the upside with either. Wolford is more mobile, more versatile. There's less tape on him. He's more of an unknown X factor. Goff is flawed, but experienced and certainly has a grasp of this offense, presumably to a much greater degree than Wolford does, being in the door in the facility 5 minutes. Goff looked, I thought going into the Seahawks game, and I picked the Rams for that game, that neither or either quarterback wouldn't necessarily impact too much for those reasons, right? You can spin the upsides and also look at the respective negatives. But looking at the way Goff was struggling so much, and I know he didn't turn the ball over, but he was struggling so badly. Yeah, another week of rehab and maybe they'll move on. But if they are forced to play Goff because Wolford hasn't recovered and he's not much different from what we saw against Seattle, the Rams are going to be in trouble, aren't they?
Yes, you'd think so. The big difference is the Green Bay defense is far better than that Seattle Seahawks defense.
Right.
And I think any quarterback will struggle against the defense, one that's better and one that's had a week off. Mm. However, you're right. Goff does have a far better grasp of this offense, a far better grasp of the offense than he does of the ball with his dodgy thumb at the moment, right. than Wolford. But I think the biggest thing in all of this is the perceived lack of, not trust, but the breakdown in the working relationship between Sean McVay and
Goff.
Jared Goff.
Yeah.
And McVay really seems to have hung his hat on Wolford, and it was the worst thing that could have happened to him, other than losing the game, is losing his starting QB, the guy that you've hung your hat on ahead of the franchise guy that you spent a lot of money on, a lot of draft picks on. Mm. And
who would you rather face? Who would you rather? So when it comes to game time, who would you rather, as a Packers fan, see suiting up against you, starting against you?
I think I would rather have the young guy. I'd rather have Wolford come in because it's a big playoff game in the cold, the frozen tundra of Lambeau Field. It's going to be -1 centigrade come the evening, maybe dropping to -4. It's a storied, historic place. So I'd rather have the less experienced guy in there than have a guy that's been taking his team to the Super Bowl. But I'm not too worried either way, because I know that Goff does have his massive limitations, the reading of the field stuff, which still hasn't gone away. That lack of that breakdown in trust with Sean McVay. So plus Goff is less mobile. He's not as likely to run about as much, which can affect Green Bay in some ways. I think back to the 2013 divisional game against the San Francisco 49ers where Colin Kaepernick ran all over Green Bay. And that still haunts me to this day.
I guess, obviously, the fitness of Goff is going to be significant as to whether he's, you know, 75% as opposed to 50%, which is what he looked like against the Seahawks. And of course, pressure, because Goff, like every quarterback in the history of the game, plays worse under pressure, but Goff, unlike every quarterback in the history of the game, is acutely bad when he's under pressure. So if the line can protect him and he's, as I say, 70-75%, then they can get into rhythm, establish Cam Akers, and it could get very, very interesting. We're breaking down that game, incidentally, on our Edge Rush show, so you can check out that pod by the time you listen to this. Edge Rush should have dropped around about now, but unfortunately, we're out of time, other than for you to leave us with a prediction. So what is your score prediction for Packers Rams?
Well, I'm going to break it down. I think the Green Bay Packers will go up big in the first half, like they do in pretty much every single game that they've had that they've won this season. So I think at halftime, it will be something like 24-10, 24-7 perhaps. The Rams will come back to within a score, and then Green Bay will end up running out 34-24 winners.
Oh, I like that. There's a lot of points on the board, according to Ollie Hunter. I like the sound of that. Hopefully we'll get snow at some point as well, if it's going to be cold conditions.
Snow game.
Yeah, we want that. We want that. I don't think in particular Jared Goff does that. He's a California boy. He's not going to enjoy it. He's not going to enjoy that football weather. It's great to see you, bud. Thank you very much for dropping by. Our listeners can follow you on Twitter, of course. Ollie Hunter?
Yep. Yeah, at Ollie Hunter on Twitter. Don't bother with Instagram. I don't post anything interesting on there. But at Ollie Hunter on Twitter, you occasionally hear me spouting off about football, soccer, and cricket on various radio channels as well.
Indeed. And most importantly of all, Kitwatch. Ollie Hunter, the brains behind Kitwatch as well. So get stuck in with that. It's great to see you, man. Thanks for dropping by. See you soon.
Love to see you, Nat. Thanks very much, man. Thanks for having me.
Fabulous stuff from Ollie Hunter. Particular props. Stripes awarded for that Texas Tech red hoodie. If you want to see that in its full glory, head on over to our social channels at The NC Show, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. That's where we put out videos all week long. Videos from the show, extra stuff as well, and lots of bonus content that rolls 7 days a week, 365. Big shout out to all of you who've taken time to leave a review on whichever platform you listen to us on. Lots of love for the Edge Rush show coming on over on our Apple podcast platform, or Apple podcast page. So we appreciate that. And Edge Rush, incidentally, dropping with me and Propo this weekend, Saturday morning. So get set. It might even be earlier, actually, of course, because they're a Saturday game. So keep your eyes and ears peeled to your feed wherever you subscribe to us. Edge Rush dropping in. We are back reviewing all the divisional round action on Monday with Greg Brady in the house. So make sure you join us Monday for that one. Enjoy the action, gang. We'll see you Monday. Bye for now.